You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the network, its advertisers, owners, or sponsors.
Hello and welcome to The Breakfast Table, the nerdiest podcast at Podcast Detroit Studios in downtown Royal Oak, Michigan.
Hey, everybody, it's Darshan. How's it going? It's Ferris.
Hi, everyone, it's Alex.
And I'm your host, Brad, and today we are joined here to talk about something that we have all loved, the stories of video games. So, when it comes to video games, one of the biggest details that everybody always asks is, how is the story? Well, we're going to get into that. How is the story of our favorite video games? What makes the story as spectacular as it is and pulls us in as people playing these games? Now, obviously, there are games that are extremely story-driven, such as Heavy Rain, Beyond Two Souls, we have Detroit Become Human coming up, where the gameplay is kind of secondary to the story of the actual game. Mm-hmm. You're pretty much playing a book at that point.
Mm-hmm. Metal Gear Solid.
Metal Gear Solid has gameplay, though.
Yeah. Metal Gear is more like
an opus.
Yeah.
It's like an opus of games that Hideo Kojima made over 20-plus years.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, when Metal Gear 4 came out, there was so much backstory. They actually created a database I don't know if you guys remember this, on PS3, there was a database you can download from the PSN that was basically like an encyclopedia of everything Metal Gear related. So, because they were hoping that Metal Gear 4 was going to be like a starting point for a lot of people, so they took their time and created like... I went through it. It was the most detailed thing I've seen. And it told you like every character, every motivation, everything that happened in every single game that Metal Gear had to do. And it was just ridiculous how big that database was.
Yeah, there are a lot of games that go into great detail when it comes to their stories and everything like that. It is almost insane for some games that you start playing it and find out all the background lore behind it. Even games that didn't even intend to have stories end up having stories, like Five Nights at Freddy's.
And Dark Souls, which Dark Souls literally, FromSoft has come out and said, we didn't make a story for this.
Or Destiny.
Right, well, Destiny tried. Dark Souls, like, they said, no, we didn't really make a lore for this. We just kind of went made things up as we went. And then people went in and started connecting two and two, saying, oh, yeah, this person's related to this person. And that's why they're doing this. And then, like, apparently FromSoft actually has, like a prize-winning campaign where if you can piece together the story between all of the games, they'll actually just straight up give you money.
Like an X prize?
Yeah.
It was like $10,000 or something like that.
Yeah. Video game plot line
for you to
X
make
prize.
Their story that they didn't make.
Yeah. It's like a hackathon, you know, or something like that.
Write the story for us.
Write the code for us instead.
Yeah. Tell me how you're going to hack Windows.
Yeah.
Can you detail it?
We'll just give you a bunch of Mountain Dew and Cheetos and, you know, give you 24 hours to get it done. Here's 10 grand if you do it.
Yeah, and you see a lot of big games like that. They do a lot of stuff where there's not really a story, but it has like enough lore in the game to where people can kind of put a lot of story together. A big thing, of course, is like MMOs. You know, MMOs have like a big, you know, like a storyline and everything, but there's always like a little lore out there where it kind of tells you more about the story and it kind of paints a big picture. Another thing would be, of course, like games like Destiny 1, where there was no story, but based on like the enemies you killed and stuff like that, and like listening to others, you can kind of piece together a story. Same thing happened like with Team Fortress 2. There was like some weird story with that. Overwatch is another one where, based off the people talking to each other, you can kind of piece together a lore.
Unreal Tournament is a great example.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Unreal Tournament. Yeah. They basically have just enough there for people to kind of get into the game. Okay, I want to know more about this person. Mm-hmm. They play more. They hear more voice lines. They hear them bickering at each other. It was like, oh, I remember that time back in the day. And you're like, oh, cool. I never knew about that. It's stuff like that. There's a lot of different ways developers tackle storytelling. And some of them are very unique, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Some of the stories that are kind of hidden in the background of the actual game end up being the most interesting because you have to actually find the story yourself. BioShock and BioShock Infinite come to mind when it comes to those games that require you to actually look for the cassette tapes that have the backstory in order to be able to tell what's going on with it. Because otherwise, you're pretty much lost. A lot of the story is hidden in the game itself.
Right.
Yeah, and it in a recent game to come to mind is Far Cry 5. I'm not going to get into too much spoilers since it's a new game, but what happens at the end of the game, actually, it can be shocking to most people when it actually comes up. But if you actually go around the world and listen to what's going on, like in the radios and stuff, it kind of hints at what's actually going to happen at the end. Mm-hmm. So, like, for people who, you know, actually go out of the world, explore, and go ahead and try to learn about the world, they actually may have a lot more information. So whenever a big twist comes in, they were like, oh, that makes a lot of sense, or wow, that's I heard about it, but I didn't expect that to come. And that's what a lot of these developers are trying to do, is trying to get people to, you know, play their game, but they're also trying to get them to explore more. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of games now have an open world. Even God of War, like the new God of War, is even though it's not as big as like Skyrim, it's still very open, and there's always something to find. It's always something story related, and I feel like that's why a lot of these games are starting to become kind of more open world than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, like speaking on that, like what would be like, I guess some of your things that you would say makes your favorite game. Like what would you say is your favorite game, and a game that, what, why a game would have a perfect story, or what formulates a perfect story for you in a video game, like. Everyone has their different reasons, you know, like example, like they enjoy searching for a back lore in a game, or they enjoy what's, I guess, given to them on the forefront and stuff like that. Like, what would you consider your favorite game that does that for you?
Like, for me, interestingly enough, it has to do with like the cinematic view. Hey, Alex, is it raining over there?
No.
It's a lot of
Yeah, we're background. Getting a lot of back.
It's probably a fan. Hold on.
Yeah. Okay. Either way. Like one of my favorite games was Unreal Tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you're doing a lot of shooting and traveling and moving around. But what I really, really appreciated was the scenery.
Mm-hmm.
Just in awe while you're going from one place to another place and crossing a bridge, you know, where a waterfall is, and just stopping in the middle of the bridge and looking around and enjoying the cinematic views.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the immersion aspect, or the way that it encapsulates you within the environment that you're playing in as you're going along the storyline and, mm-hmm. and going through it, how I guess to me it's the immersion factor.
Right.
You know? How much of it I'm actually really into it.
Right.
You know?
What is it for me? Like when it comes to a specific game, like I enjoy holes being left into the story for me to want to go look for.
Like Easter egg
type of things? Kind of like Easter eggs, or like example, like let's say they're talking about.
So basically plot lines that are still in the game, mm-hmm. but they're not just given to you.
Yeah. Like example, like one of my favorite games of all time is Metroid Fusion. Like it's possibly.
Metroid Fusion?
Mm-hmm.
What system?
Game Boy.
Okay.
Game Boy Advance.
Okay.
It's technically the next game after Super Metroid. Technically. But like it's a game where you can jump into it and play it as a Metroid game and not have any understanding of what's going on in the background, but there's so much that's being said around things that happen in the background. You're like, I want to go see what happened, whether you go play those older games or you actually go look up what's happening, because like you get a, you know, situations where Samus is like, yeah, when you were on like when you fought Kraid, like this and this happened, and you're like, who's Kraid? What did this happen? And then you start to see why she.
And then you fall into those like video game rabbit holes, mm-hmm. where you're just like searching all over.
Yeah.
So it's like the thrill of the seek.
Yeah.
To you, after the fact, mm-hmm. of completing the game, right?
Yeah. Like
not just during the game.
No, like I'm that person. Like so, most people like when it like, and not even just for video games. Like I'm the person that will spoil something for myself just because I want to know the information right then and there. So like example, like let's say I'm watching something and you know it's like, oh, such and such did this, and I was like. What did they do?
So you're the guy that has.
I will read ahead.
You got.
But then watch.
You got to find the angle.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, all right. Okay. So what's really going on here? I got to figure that out before I even go forward.
Yeah, and I do that with everything, like anime. I'll do it with movies and stuff like that, just because it's like, I want to know, but I don't want to wait the time for them to show it on screen. Then I'll find it out, and then if it's interesting, like, all right, let's watch there. So, but if it's not, I'll be like, all right, I'm done with this.
Choose your own adventure books are not good for Ferris.
Not at all.
He's going to read all the sections.
Ferris is just reading it like a normal book going, this doesn't make any sense at all. They're jumping plot lines, and characters keep dying and reappearing.
It's like, why is there a dragon in my grandma's bedroom? What? It's like, I got to go back on this one.
Yeah, and for me, I mean, for me, it's kind of more like like giving you like an emotional feeling when playing the game, like when you feel attached to the characters and what's happening in the game. Like a big example, of course, my favorite game of all time is The Last of Us. I'm not going to go into too much story, but when they take the time for you to really care about the characters, like you care about Ellie, like Joel is supposed to protect her, but even though you're playing the game, you want to protect her, even though she can't die. And then like the stuff that happens, like even like there's this moment in the game where you meet another guy and his little brother, and then you get the, even though they're in there for a short amount of time, by the end of that, of the story, you are with them. What, you know, whatever happens, it makes you feel for them, and it hurts when stuff happens to them, or you know, something else like that. And then also for like Uncharted, you know, the overall stories in Uncharted, they're not great. You know, it's just treasure hunting and stuff like that. But when you play the game, you learn a lot about Drake and Elena, their relationship. One of my favorite moments in gaming is from Uncharted 4. You're just sitting at their house, and Elena bets that you can't beat her score in Crash Bandicoot. So then you both sit on the couch, and you literally play Crash Bandicoot, like an actual level of Crash Bandicoot, trying to beat her level score. And it's just getting attached to those characters. And, you know,
so you're talking about like the emotional buildup, the character development, and kind of the empathy that you feel towards these people within the game, or yeah, characters within the game. And then, you know, what happens to them, basically.
Yeah, and yeah, one of the biggest things, and also just making you feel something, because I know, you know, games you could shoot people and winning and stuff, but like when the game makes you actually feel something, it's different. Like one of the best games I could probably give an example for is Spec Ops The Line. And when you play Spec Ops, you just think it's just, you know, standard military shooter, third person shooter, and you know, blah blah blah. But there's a moment in the game where you get intel that, you know, there's some bad guys across, you know, the city, and then you have a choice to, you know, use white phosphorus, which is a deadly you know, nuclear gas,
like that a can chemical weapon.
Exactly. Yeah. So when you go,
and that's some gray area stuff right there. Yeah.
Exactly. So you make the decision to use it, and then okay, target's eliminated, and then once you start going down the street, once you get to the end, you realize that you just dropped almost a nuclear bomb on citizens. So you actually walking through and you see, you know, children dead, you know, husbands and wives. You just walk, you just see the aftermath, and it just makes you feel like a terrible person. And you thought you were doing something good. And it's just when you're playing this game, and this game is very psychological. If you've ever watched Apocalypse Now, it's almost very similar to that. It's a very psychological game, and it makes you feel a lot
it's
of
like
different emotions.
It's virtual PTSD or virtual shell shock.
Exactly. And without spoiling the end of the game, like it just makes you feel like crap. It by the end of the game, it just makes you feel like absolute crap, realizing all the stuff that you did in the game. And you know, games are violent. You shoot people, you kill people, but it's no problem. But when a game can make you feel like absolute crap after killing someone, then you know that the game did something right. And that's what I like. I like it when something brings you into the game, and even though you did nothing wrong, really, you still feel like, oh god, I feel horrible for doing that. And it's just one of those feelings that I just you don't see in like movies and stuff. And I think that's what I like about games like Last of Us, Uncharted, Spec Ops, and stuff like that.
Basically, it's the immersion factor that brings you in, that it makes you feel like you're a part of the story itself.
Correct.
Instead of just watching, you know, cliff notes of what's going to happen in the game, pretty much, instead of controlling it.
And just like Brad mentioned earlier, for Bioshock, like in Bioshock, you can have the choice to either save a little sister or kill her. Like, that's another thing, you know, even though and I know Brad knows what I'm talking about, and choice, you get a choice, like, do you want to what was it you could do? You could either,
it's like you save the little sister, but you won't get as much atom.
Yeah,
but,
or you can
steal the atom from them, which kills
exactly
them.
Kills them, yeah.
So it makes you feel terrible. Like, it's like, okay, well, I can be more powerful, but I'm killing a little girl for it. It's just stuff like that. It's just that's what I like about with some games with storytelling.
Look at Ferris. Ferris is like, I'll sacrifice that girl.
My entire run through of Bioshock, I killed every single little sister. Like, I sat there and I was
you
like,
are a sacrifice.
I was over here like, their lives are done. They're already little sisters. I'm just doing them a service. I need this atom.
take them out
their,
of their misery.
Eyes are already yellow. They're dead on the inside. I might as well make them dead on the outside.
Right. How
too.
Do I know they don't have jaundice?
Yeah. Like, I was just.
But I will say, I do agree, especially when it comes to the characterization in, you know, video games and everything, especially with Last of Us, because I remember specifically playing that game and like halfway through it, the entire game is an escort mission, which most people hate.
The game was one big fanfic.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And by halfway through the game, I just remember thinking, I swear, if anything happens to this little girl, I am flying to Naughty Dog Studios. I'm making them rewrite the game, re-release it. This is not happening. I care too much about this now.
Especially like when it's for like a girl, because most of the time that happens like when you're playing a game where it's like a dog. You're like, oh, if someone kills his dog, I'm gonna riot. Yeah. But when it makes you feel like that for a human, then you know that they did something right, because everyone loves animals. So I forget what games, like Fallout or something happens. Like, I swear to God, if this dog dies.
Yeah,
you know,
like meat something.
Dog meat and Fallout.
Oh, there you go.
You know, the funny thing is, like, now that you bring up Fallout and we're speaking of like characters that you really cared about in the game, I cared little about almost everyone in Fallout except Liberty Prime. I don't think he deserved to die the way he did. That man, that robot.
So for people that have not played Fallout and to understand, Liberty Prime is a giant Transformer-like robot in the game.
He was the embodiment of Uncle Sam in robot form, and also had the ability to throw nukes as his main weapon of choice. He would throw nukes on the ground like people throw Pop Rocks on 4th of July.
Talk about American propaganda at its best.
That whole game was.
Oh, it was.
The whole game was what if World War III happened? That's the entire
game. Nuclear Holocaust. Not even World War III, just nuclear Holocaust.
Post-apocalyptic.
Occurred.
Yeah. Yes. So the world's constantly stuck in like a 1950s, 60s-esque Cold War aesthetic. So everyone knows about a world where, like, you know, nuclear war has happened or it was on the forefront. They ended up making like shelters called Fallout shelters where people can go back and hide, right? Like, it was something you can dig underground and hide so you don't get hit with nuclear fallout. You can survive the blast if it drops near you.
So it's like a culture at this point.
Mm-hmm. So then people, you know, obviously, see, like, once it started happening, like, people's vaults started expiring, so maybe people died in the vaults, or people who did actually make it out, like, you happen to be one of those people that makes it out, and you kind of venture the Capital Wasteland or whatever game it is, and seeing what the hell happened to the world after that.
So, and they actually
open world,
very. I mean, it's made by Bethesda, so it's, you know, Skyrim except nukes.
Yeah, the big thing about it is it's a game series they made so they could continually release new games for it, because each new game takes place in a different area of the world after the Fallout occurred. So you have New Vegas, which takes place in Nevada around Las Vegas. And the vaults are located everywhere. So each game you only see like about 10 vaults or so. And,
but each one of them has their own, like, crazy story. Like, one of them – like the vault you come out of in Fallout 3, you're just a generic vault. Like, everyone there just lived there the entire time of the nuclear fallout. But no one ever ventured outside, and then you find out your dad ventures outside, and you kind of follow him. Like, why did he go out there? To kind of figure out what he's doing in the world. But then, like, you get other vaults where it's like, oh, this one's running a simulation where they're living a normal day-to-day life. They don't even know that they're in a simulation, and then you find
they
out.
They think that they left the vault, and there was really no –
There's a Matrix.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of – it's a lot of psychological stuff. There's some where all the vaults – that vault only had all girls, so they were doomed to fail because it's like an underlying story that, like, the people who made the vaults, Vault Tech, they ended up making the vaults to test on people because they had already opted in. It was kind of like a terms and conditions thing.
They were a psychology company. They pretty much wanted to see what humans would do in certain scenarios. Like, I think my favorite is one where the vault was all drug addicts and everything like that, and they had to get clean. And then they, after a certain amount of time, they just started leaving drugs out everywhere in the vault to see if they would go back to using them. And of course,
they were drug addicts. So
they were drug addicts. So even though they were clean for like 3 years.
Each one was like a closed environment for like science experiments.
That's literally what each one was. Like, a lot of them were normal to kind of give you the idea of normalcy.
A control test.
Yeah. And then there was ones that were control tests and just like, that's what was happening there.
Yeah. And then you have vaults that ended up revolting. So they were supposed to be like vaults that were doing something for a year, but the people found out that they were being tested on and stuff. So they would kill the people that were overseeing them and then ran the vault as per normal. You know, and then they would open it up and you'd get those vaults that you could go in and be like, oh, you guys are all normal in here and you're okay with people coming in and leaving and everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So like, oh, yeah, but we just killed everybody in charge.
Yeah, we just killed the overseers.
We just run the place. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a great game.
It's a great game series.
They're fun. Yeah, they're very fun. And but the thing with like open world games is that I think we've talked about this like before on a podcast is that a lot of the times open world games suffer in storyline because they have to like sacrifice some storytelling so they can get, because especially when it's open world, because nothing, usually some things aren't in chronological order. So you can take a mission that says, oh, this bomb is going to explode and kill everyone. And then you could do that mission like a week from then and it not change anything. And mm-hmm. I think we talked about it, like how sometimes storytelling can suffer in open world games. Do you guys kind of agree with that?
Yeah, yeah. I agree.
It's definitely the world building mm-hmm. at that point, because I couldn't tell you much about any of the plots of any of the Fallout games, like the actual main story. I can give you like your dad left the vault and you got to hunt him down, and New Vegas is you got to track down this guy that tried to kill you, and mm-hmm. you know, and 4, it's your son was kidnapped. Okay, cool. Those are the main plot lines, but I could tell you everything else that happens in the world in those games.
Tell you all kinds of stuff that's in the background, and like,
oh yeah,
and like that's what a lot of open world games and a lot of games that just try to like mash together a story. They get stuck with either they make a story that can be done out of order, so then maybe the story won't link up properly, or they'll leave the story to be found, but it could be quite a bit of work you have to do to find it. Like example with Fallout, like all that lore. You're only going to find that if you explore almost every inch of that level, which is incredibly huge.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of that stuff is going to be left to cannon fodder. Like, you're not going to see it.
There's definitely a fine line between mm-hmm. playing a video game that feels like a movie where mm-hmm. you're just pushing the buttons as you go along. A little bit like with – not so much, but like Choose Your Adventure with Heavy Rain mm-hmm. or, for example, I mean in my experience with the PlayStation 3 version of Metal Gear Solid 4 – mm-hmm. I just felt like it was just like I was just playing a movie.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And then there's that fine line between that experience and as well as the open world experience mm-hmm. where there's too little of a storyline that's involved. I think that there's just like there's got to be some sort of fine balance. And that's what you're seeing with a lot of, I guess, experiments with these games, you know, like, you know, some are more open world than others and some have better storylines than others as a result. So. Right. It's give and take, you know?
Yeah. And actually, sorry. And I got to say, the best example, in my opinion, is The Witcher. The Witcher 3, I think, is a perfect balance of open world and still balancing out a good story. Because every side mission had a story. There was not one filler side story in that game. Everything in that game had a story to it. And I think that's what they did so well with it.
Most of my friends that play that game, they actually like – they're one of the
people – You haven't seen them in years.
Not only that, actually go back and replay the game because, you know, mm-hmm. the different outcomes that it has.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, what if I did this differently or what if I did that differently?
Yeah, and like even like – so we've talked about like the idea of like, you know, what we enjoy in a game or like what makes a game a great story-based game for us. But like I guess kind of goes to the opposite side of it. Like does a game have to have a really good story to be considered a good game? Like even if the game doesn't have, let's say, a story, or if it does have a story but it's not that great but other options in the game are redeeming, can the story specifically make it so the game's not as great? Or if it doesn't have a story, can it make it where it's not as great?
I mean, you can definitely have games with terrible stories or practically no story at all mm-hmm. that are still great. Like Mario Sunshine, the story in that game –
Don't you dare. Isle Delfino was up Poop's Creek without a ladder. All right. Literally, there's poop everywhere.
But the mechanics of a game can definitely save a game that doesn't have a very good story.
Oh, look, are you going to say like Super Mario Sunshine?
Yeah. Like Super Mario Sunshine.
And actually, another example, the biggest example of that is first-person shooters, because most first-person shooters for their campaigns aren't that great. They have terrible – they're just, you know, Hollywood stuff, Call of Duty, Battlefield. They're almost never good at all. And they're just there to kind of get you to learn the mechanics so you can play online. But the game is still fun to play. Now, Battlefield 1, I think, did it right because they did like mini stories throughout. Instead of doing like, oh, here's the horrors of World War One, you know, about how, you know, this guy was assassinated and how they did this. They didn't do that stuff. They just said, hey, we're going to go to Africa. We're going to tell the story about this soldier and stuff like that. You know, they told a personal story and then they moved on to a guy on the other side of the world fighting, you know, the Germans and stuff. That did it perfectly. But most first-person shooters, they have terrible stories, but they're still fun to play. And then you could jump on to multiplayer and then spend all your hours there. And then of course we have the big one, Destiny. Destiny 1 had a terrible story
people still play that game.
Yeah, people play that a lot.
I was playing that prior to me getting here.
Really? It's a fun game. I enjoyed it. I had fun, but I mean, I can't tell you
what is this one that's really hot right now? Fortnite or something?
We're not talking about that.
I don't know. Does it have a story?
We don't talk about that game.
Does it even have a story?
No.
Yeah, kind of.
Okay, there's an example of something like that.
I played the PvP. Well, I don't know.
I mean, I guess that game technically would fall into the category of other games that are solely multiplayer based that have no story. But I'm not going to name drop any game that happens to have that same formula.
okay, I'll shut up.
But either way, like I heard you were talking about like Halo and stuff like that. Using that as an example as a bad story, Halo has an amazing.
Okay, whatever. But no, because Alex got a good point, which is it's just enough to get you online so you can start shooting.
Halo has an amazing story.
I mean, it's got
Halo
a story.
Halo does have a good story. Then you have games like Battlefield Bad Company. Yeah, it's a first-person shooter, but that has a great story.
A lot of games that are multiplayer-oriented that have a story, that's where, like, we Call of Duty is in your Battlefields, that's where it goes. But some games, like, obviously that's the what that gets them in the stirrups, you know, like Halo example, that game. People played it for the story. They're like, I want to know about the story of Master Chief. What did he get himself into? How can he get out of it? And then, oh, yeah, I'm going to play in multiplayer, but this story's got to get done first. You know,
And actually, you have a good point. Actually, you have a good point there, Ferris. Speaking with Halo, because one of the things I do like as well is stories you already know about, but then you actually get to live it. You actually get to play it or actually experience it. So before Halo Reach came out, we knew what's going to happen. We knew what happened on Reach. We know the story behind it. Mm-hmm. But then the game came out, and we're like, I already know what happens, but I want to experience it. Right. I like games like that, you know, like Final Fantasy VII, like when you learn about Zack and how he died and stuff like that. But then the prequel came out where they told that story. I like games that do that. You know, they kind of make a game where they tell a backstory of someone.
Like I feel like a lot of game companies unfortunately don't do well with prequels, or they don't even go down the route of prequels. Like example. I'm not going to bring that series up. That's later. Specifically, like Gears of War, right? Like, so I was a huge Gears of War fan, and Gears of War was a game where a lot of people did play it was actually a game that was more story based, and then its multiplayer ended up overtaking it as a whole. And then it was just people were looking for both sides. Like, we're just super excited for whatever came out Gears of War related. But the thing is, like, obviously in first Gears of War, like you get introduced to Marcus. He's currently locked up because he did something on Aspho Fields, which is something that you never go to in any of the games, something that you're never told about. And then you find out, oh, he did something on Aspho Fields. Also, the city we're in right now is getting attacked, so we're going to let you out because we know you're a really great warrior. And then you kind of see the trials and tribulations of what they're dealing about on planet Sarah, and then find out, like, technically the ants on planet Sarah are attacking them and they don't like the fact that they're there. And then, you know, it's just a big tirade and fight between two different species. But it's like something that, like, we got prequel games, but they went over stuff that no one cared about. Like, we get games that do go over great prequels like Halo with Halo Reach, but then you get like another series like Gears of War where you get Judgment and it explains why Baird is a thing, but no one
cared
about
him. Yeah, but when you look at that, those games that had those terrible prequels felt like filler so they can get out, so they can prepare for the next game. Yeah, because like a big example, Gears of War Judgment, God of War Ascension, that was a prequel that was just a bridge between 3 and this and the new God of War. And then there was the Uncharted game on Vita, that was basically a bridge between 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of those games where either they're skipping generations, like they're like the last of the generation, they need to just put something out. And then you have the true prequels, like, you know, like you said, Halo Reach, and Metal Gear Solid 3. That's another perfect example. Metal Gear Solid 3 was technically a prequel, but it didn't it didn't jump generations. It was made for a purpose. You know, when prequels are made for a purpose,
it still had its own central plot.
There you go. Yeah. When prequels are made for a purpose, then they could be really good. It's only when they just need to get something out just so we don't have to wait for the next game and stuff like that. We see that a lot. But
from a consumer's perspective, you don't know what to anticipate in regards to the quality of the game when you're purchasing it, though.
Oh, you can usually tell. Yeah. You can usually, Most gamers can tell real quick when it's just a, hey, this is just to tide you over until the real one comes out between this is going to be a real game.
Yeah, like example, like it's going back to Gears of War, like they had Gears of War Ultimate Edition that came out on the Xbox One. It was the first Gears of War game that came out on Xbox One, but it was just a remake of the first game, but had content that you normally couldn't play on console from the PC version of the Gears of War 1. So people were like, yeah, I'll play it. Plus it's Gears of War 1 on my Xbox One, so it's going to have dedicated servers and all this crazy stuff. And it gives you, you know, Gears of War 1, 2, and 3 to play again. But it's like you knew that you were buying that because, oh, I want to relive this one more time. And also because like I'm getting Gears of War 4.
The God of War re-release for like PlayStation 3 for all the ones that came out on 2.
Exactly.
And then,
and so it's just something to kind of
then like same thing for PlayStation 4 when they all came out for 4. I get it.
Yeah.
Crash Bandicoot.
Batman Origins is another one.
Yeah. So like, and speaking of like games that like that prequels are for a purpose and then prequels that are just there for like a cash grab kind of. The thing that I enjoy about a lot of different game series is that they'll just release games in some ridiculous order where it doesn't make sense. So example, you know, we'll get games like Metal Gear where it will go, you know, let's say Metal Gear 1 and Metal Gear 2, right? Okay. They actually are chronological. They go over different things. But then you get to Metal Gear Solid 1. I was like, oh, yeah, this is technically third in the line. But now why is Solid in the name? What's who's Solid? But you find out Solid is a character you've been playing as for two games already. I was like, oh, okay, let's keep going. Then two. Oh, yeah, this is actually a continuation. Cool. Then Metal Gear Solid 3 comes out. Oh, yeah, it's all the way back. It's the first
boss.
It's the first dude. He kind of looks like the guy you're playing.
But it's not him.
We'll get into that later. And then that's where you start getting the convoluted story because then you get that and then they start releasing a whole bunch of games in between because then you got all the portable ops games, which technically took place before Metal Gear and after Metal Gear Solid 3 and then – you get the 4, which is technically the last game in the series.
Yeah,
but
4 takes place five. So far in the future.
Yeah, it's like 4 takes place, I think, 10 years after 2. But it doesn't – like they never explained why certain people are which ways. Fun fact, I will explain this just small tidbit of a story with Metal Gear. So Metal Gear is a very tactical and like kind of like weird – sci-fi kind of series where like, you know, like you have people who are like, oh yeah, we're why are you a part of this organization? Okay, yeah, I'm sent from America to go kill you. All right, sweet. And then they do that and it's like, oh wait, why was it hard to kill you? Oh yeah, because you had this gigantic metal robot that shoots nukes. So then you have to figure out how to kill that metal robot. And then, you know, hence that's the name of Metal Gear. That's what your the premise is. Everyone happens to have one somehow. But then you get to situations where it's like you get hypothetical characters. Like you'll get characters like Psycho Mantis who he's just someone who's psychic. Like he literally knows telekinesis and he can read your mind.
And it's never explained.
And they never explain what he is. He just happens to be this being.
He's like a filler character.
No, he was not.
No.
No,
he's an important character to the story, but they don't explain his backstory at all.
They explain his backstory, what his power is. Or they explain his power, but where he got it from, none of that. And then like you get my favorite unexplained character from Metal Gear. He was introduced in Metal Gear Solid 2. His name was Vamp. Now, if you listen to his name, you would think, oh yeah, Vamp, yeah, that sounds pretty cool. Is he a vampire? Yeah, he's a vampire. So we're in a world where everything's hyper realistic. Espionage is a real thing. Alliteration's a thing. Everyone's fighting over the world's profits and money.
And robots.
And there's a vampire.
With nukes.
And he's a real one. Like, he's not like, oh, he's kind of like one. Like, he really likes Dracula. Like, no, he can't die. He can't be out in the sun. He's super aerobatic and stuff like that. And so, okay, why is he a vampire? And they never tell you. He disappears. Like, you fight him once. He disappears, falls into the ocean, air quotes. And then you're like, oh, yeah, he's dead. But wait, vampires don't die by drowning. So I guess that doesn't count. And then And then you go to the fourth game and it's like, now we have Raiden, the guy from the second game. I was like, oh yeah, he was a trainee. Why is he a robot?
That I think that is my favorite part of the entire thing is, hold on, isn't that naked guy from the second game?
Naked guy with cartwheels? But yeah, like you find out like he's this guy who had nothing to lose. Like he was a trainee to become this great espionage agent, but he only did virtual missions, so he never had any combat training. He ends up, you know, doing great in the second game, and then that's kind of like the last time you hear of him. And then comes back in the third game, or fourth game rather, he's
a robot. He has no body parts. He just has his face, so you can kind of know who he is, but the rest of him is just robot ninja.
It's half his face. It's not even his full face. It's half a face.
Yeah, and then he's just a robot ninja. And then it's like, okay, sweet, he's cool. Oh, there's a Metal Gear. Okay, I'm already jaded to this idea. Sweet. Then Vamp comes back. And it was like, what? Oh, my God. You're telling me there's a robot here that shoots nukes that has weirdly organic legs, a vampire, and a robot ninja all fighting.
Hold on. Doesn't Psycho Mantis come back in 4 as well?
No, we'll go over Metal Gear at a later date. But either way,
we'll digress from there because
the story's crazy.
We could dedicate a whole podcast to this.
Ferris. I could explain the entirety of that, and that's I will nuts. Sit there, get angry the whole time. But yeah, like
we know what grinds your Metal Gears.
Play in traffic over there on 11 Mile.
I'm just going to walk out of the studio and just, hey, Darshan, come on over here. I got to show you something in the middle of the road.
Yeah, but like, yeah, like wrapping around back to the concept is like, I enjoy games that like, they have something that obviously I already mentioned it before. It was like stuff that you have to go kind of grab for. And it's like, okay, why does this happen? And like Metal Gear was one of the big series that did that for me because they would just throw stuff in and just expect you to know it because you remembered one small thing from a game prior that somehow blew up into something ginormous. Like, I'm not even dope. I'm not doing it. I'm not doing it. I almost talked about something else from Metal Gear. But still, either way.
Yeah, that is one thing. When you get into a game series that happens to have so many games that you're kind of – they keep making callbacks to the original game. And by that time, you're kind of going, hold on. Is that really a callback or am I forgetting something? What is this game? Because mm-hmm. Ratchet and Clank had that problem.
Mm-hmm.
Because the first game came out on the PS2 in 90.
Yeah, it was a PS2 game, so it wouldn't have come out in the 90s. PS3 came out in 2000.
Never mind, like 2001. Yeah. 2001. I was close. But by the time you got to like the PS3 ones, like A Crack in Time and everything like that, mm-hmm. They made references to the first and second games in the series. And I know for me, they just went right over my head because mm-hmm. I had already forgotten everything that happened in those two games.
By the time it gets released, it's already been a couple of years. So
right. It was already like a decade between.
It's not like you're going to play the first one before you even get the second one, like the mm-hmm. day before to get all the references.
Yeah, I mean, some people do that.
Some people do that with like movies.
I did that with Mass Effect when Mass Effect 3 was coming out. I played the first two games over that weekend prior.
If you can, you know. Yeah. Not everyone does.
But no, like I definitely see what you're saying because I was a big fan of Ratchet & Clank as well. But,
Clank, I love that game series. Top game series, easily.
One of my favorite game series. And like in like each one of the games, like they do like have something that like you'll see happen in the next game. It's like, oh yeah, that's Quark. Oh yeah, I know him, right? Like Captain Quark. Like he's this weirdly Superman-esque guy that doesn't really have any powers. He's kind of like the Hercule
of
messes
series. Up everything.
Yeah, he's terrible, but apparently he had some good times, so people praise him. And like, you know, you see him go from a hero to a villain over the series. It's like, wait, what? He was the good guy. And then, you know, then the thing that sucked is like when you got the remake of Ratchet and Clank 1, they took things out of the game and some story points didn't exist because they wanted to formulate it for the movie.
They also added new things into the game mm-hmm. that kind of changed characters around and everything. Mm-hmm. Like in the original, that's something else is when they completely start changing the story to readapt it to a new generation. Mm-hmm. And you lose part of what made the story great. Because mm-hmm. in the original Ratchet and Clank, Ratchet is a complete jerk to everybody. Mm-hmm. He only cares about himself. And the only reason he helps Clank in the first game is because he thinks he's going to be getting something out of it. Like, he never cares about saving the world. He's like, I could steal some stuff from that planet if we go there. You know what? Yeah, I'll join you. Let's go there.
We get down. We're going to get some cheddar cheese.
But then you get to the remake where it's like now he wants to be a part of like this weird elite squadron of space cadets.
And so he can save the universe.
Ratchet's not.
That's not Ratchet.
Ratchet's a terrible person.
Yeah.
Like, I think the thing that hurt me the most, so this is a joke that I enjoyed in the first game. So one of the first planets you go to outside of like when you meet Clank, I can't remember the planet, but you end up going into this weird irrigation system where you have to fly up some weird like pipelines and then you see this guy bent over. And Ratchet walks up and was like, hey, look, plumber's crack. And then like the guy was like, what did you say? And was like, oh yeah, plumber's back. But in the next game, like when they remade the game, that joke wasn't there at all.
Oh, yeah.
They just removed it. And it was like, I was surprised that I remember something so small, but it's just like, this is a big part of your game. Why are you removing your jokes that are amazing?
Yeah, not only because that joke is a part of Ratchet's old character as well, mm-hmm. of where he was just a complete jerk to everyone.
Everyone, yeah.
Like, including Clank. Like, Ratchet and Clank were not buddies in the first two games at all. Mm. It wasn't until the third game.
You would never thought of that if you saw the movie.
Right. No. If you
they were buddies.
Yeah, they were buddies.
They were best friends from the start.
I mean, you saw in the beginning it was like kind of for him, like what he could get out of the situation. But at the same time, like it turned around like that.
Yeah, it's so when you have those situations where you have a story where you have these characters built up and then you're like, you know what? I like that we have this lore and everything like that. Let's redo it and completely get rid of everything that people loved about these characters.
Right. It's just I don't know. Like I understand the idea of like changing the story, I guess, for certain things to capture a new generation. But it's like don't ruin it so much to the point where people who are excited to see this new iteration or like get to play their game in, you know, 4K or something like that. Because, you know, we got that new age and then you ruined it somehow. So that's the thing that kind of sucks about them. But
or you get those games that are just tacked on for the story and not so much to add more to the story, but to cash grab, and they can end up ruining the story. Like, we already talked about that with God of War Ascension, kind of did that.
Cash grab fillers.
Yeah, the Uncharted game for the Vita, it's
a lot of the Metal Gear games on PlayStation, on PSP, besides the, there was actually one of
are you talking about
was
the Spec
pretty
Ops?
Pretty much there's every, three, almost every
there,
game.
There was the, three yeah, Metal Gear games on the PS, well, four, sorry.
But there was one that was really good that was with Big Boss. It took place like right after – it was like directly after 3.
It was technically Portable Ops takes place right after 3 because that's him building Outer Heaven. And then Peace Walker is when like
– Peace Walker is the big one. That was one, fantastic.
Because that's
game,
when they
though.
Start introducing like actual like Metal Gears and stuff like that. Because Peace Walker – I mean Portable Ops was kind of like – a game test to see if they could make something like Peace Walker, but people bought it anyway because it added some form of story to the series, even though it was a very small bit. So, yeah, you had that. And then
you guys ever play one game? I don't mean to change the subject from Metal Gear, but you guys ever heard of one called Bloodborne?
Yeah.
Yeah. I heard that's got like a really good storyline going for it. Shout out to that game. One of my good buddies plays that one.
Yeah, it's just like how we were talking about Dark Souls earlier. It's one of those games that has the lore on like the world building kind of. That's where all most of the story and lore comes from.
Yeah, you're pretty much a guy with a giant weird shaped sword that goes gothic, around killing people.
But the storyline's quite gothic and pretty good.
It's literally Bloodborne was there. So FromSoft is one, a Japanese company, right? And the Dark Souls games are technically JRPGs. But people really don't know that. So they're like, I wouldn't play Final Fantasy, but you play Dark Souls. But either way, so Dark Souls was their attempt at like a medieval kind of like supernatural game with magic and all that kind of stuff. And then Bloodborne was their take on a very dark and grim gothic / Victorian game.
Yes.
So that's actually not correct. So Dark Souls is made by Namco Bandai. From Software did Demon Souls and Bloodborne. Those are the only two games that From Software did. Namco Bandai did the Dark Souls games.
FromSoft made every single Souls game and Bloodborne, but they have two teams. They have an A team that made Demon Souls, Dark Souls 1, and Dark Souls 3, and then their second team made Dark Souls 2 and Bloodborne. I was going to say FromSoft entirely owns Dark Souls.
I hear the clickety clacks from Alex's MacBook.
It's like fact check.
Yeah, it's like I'm about to Google this.
The best part is Alex has been silent since those keyboard strokes, probably just going, oh, no, oh, no.
So what did we find, Alex?
Was that?
did we find some new changes there?
He was too busy Googling to know what was going on.
But yeah, I guess. I couldn't even remember what was going on there. But yeah, like with Dark Souls and all that, that was their attempts. One of the attempts were like their ways of like kind of cultivating it and see how they could attack it. That's why they really didn't, as they already mentioned, like they didn't make a story. They just kind of threw some stuff in because they wanted to kind of get the aesthetic down. And then that's where like people started piecing stuff together. Mm. Kind of like how you said with Unreal where, you know, people, you know, I hate you, Malcolm. Why did you do this? And blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, find out, oh, yeah, him and Malcolm fought in this weird war. But now they're in this tournament where they can fight to the death and kill each other, but not kill each other. But they see some giblets, you know.
Yeah.
So that's it's one of those kind
it's
of things.
It's a dynamic thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So
dynamic development, character development.
But on a side bit of that, I guess I kind of started it with Metal Gear. But I want to finish it with at least Castlevania. going into a story series or like a storyline of a series that I enjoy the most, or like I at least can explain fairly thoroughly, I want to try to explain Castlevania.
Hey, can I ask you real quick before you do?
Yeah.
What do you think of the animated series that's on Netflix in comparison to the video game?
I like it a lot.
And like, I think it's more so an adaptation, or is it more accurate?
It's technically an adaptation, but they haven't really like kind of gone over it because it's
Everything's been pre-game so far.
Everything's okay. Pre-game. Well, it's yes and no, because technically all the characters that they've introduced so far, so like Trevor knowing Alucard, Trevor doesn't know Alucard until Castlevania 3, because that's like Trevor's only game, right? So I'm curious to see how it goes.
Yeah.
Because like I want to see if they're going to go from it being, you know, Trevor fighting Alucard and finding out, oh yeah, we both hate Dracula, let's go do this. Because Alucard is literally Dracula's son, but in other portrayals, he's not someone who is like on Dracula's side. He actually just hates his dad, and then, you know, they end up fighting and all that nice stuff, and Dracula gets clapped up like 14 times. But like, it's just that I want to see if they're going to go into the other characters from Castlevania 3, and this is going to be like a light to see stuff about Castlevania 3, because okay. No one ever talks about the game.
All right, well, go on okay. About the game. So, I just wanted to know a little bit about what you felt about that.
I think it's really cool. How well you can condense the story of this series.
I appreciate that sum up or TLDR.
Spark notes.
Including all those DS games.
Yeah. So I'm going to go over just characters. I'm not going to go over specific games because that's going to be really hard to do.
Oh, yeah. It goes back to the Nintendo series in the 80s and 90s.
So basically, what makes you love this game series?
So what I like about the series is that, like, it's a very simplistic thing, right? Castlevania is literally a weird take on the Bram Stoker kind of, like, storyline of, like, Dracula and Frankenstein and all that other stuff. But technically avoiding some things because they don't want copyright. And it's just about a clan of people called Belmonts who have access to this thing called a vampire killer that's literally made to only kill Dracula. But it can do stuff and kill other people and do it, use it for all the crazy whip-related things. But really, it's a weapon that can only be used by Belmonts that has holy power that can kill Dracula if it, you know, slaps him up enough. So
you're talking about that whip?
Yeah, the whip that they have. Yeah,
I remember that.
So
all too well.
The whole thing about Castlevania, like, there's a whole bunch of different series and like different characters that like kind of get introduced. So if I'm going like chronologically, so the first game is technically Castlevania: Lament of Innocence. That one takes place in like the 1100s. It introduced Leon Belmont. He's someone that he doesn't even know about the lineage of what the vampire killer is yet. He doesn't even he doesn't even know who what the vampire killer is, what his purpose is. He's literally someone who just happens to be fighting this weird cult that kind of is demonistic in some way, shape, or form, and ends up like kidnapping his wife and kind of killing his wife. He ends up kind of getting kind of upset about that because obviously his wife is gone. Ends up the power of his wife gets – or like the soul of his wife gets put into the vampire killer. It ends up becoming the vampire killer in what we know and love, and it gets the power of being able to knock down evil's bane, kind of like the Master Sword in a sense, right? Nintendo was very close on a lot of different things. But they end up getting to that point, and then end up the cultist that they're finding, one of the guys, the cultist, he ends up really, really liking demonistic things to the point where he becomes Dracula himself. And then it just gets to the age-old thing of they're fighting Dracula. He ends up killing the guy because obviously he killed his wife, and then the vampire killer is born. Obviously, you see the start of Belmonts versus Dracula. Why does Dracula keep coming back? What's going on? And then after that, you skip a couple hundred years and you end up going to the game Castlevania, the one that we all know and love. That introduces
Medusa?
Medusa, technically, yes. She's introduced
in there. That's what I remember. Had a hard time fighting her. Thank you very much.
Why can I not remember his name right now? I can't remember that specific Belmont's name.
Never remember any of the Belmont's names, to be honest.
I want to look it up.
Trevor.
Is it Trevor in that one?
I don't think he's in that.
I don't think
Simon.
Simon Belmont.
Simon Belmont.
Yeah. So you get introduced to Simon. He doesn't really have like much of a purpose. He just knows that Dracula's castle has appeared. We all know Dracula's in there. He's got to go in there and go clap up Dracula because he might do some dumb stuff again. So he ends up goes in there, you know, fights all kinds of different monsters. You end up seeing, you know, a giant bat. We're just like, hey, wait, is that Dracula? Yeah. No, it's just a giant bat. He goes there, finds that. He fights
Medusa.
The thing. Frankenstein. He ends up fighting the mummy. He ends up fighting Medusa. He ends up fighting a lot of the popular like horror tropes that you see, but obviously they can't call him that because of copyright reasons. Then he ends up beating, you know, Dracula, and then that's the end of the day. Then you end up going to another game where you get to Castlevania 2, which is the next one in the chronological order, where he ends up – Dracula is alive again. Or no,
he's in a world where Dracula's gone, but somehow Dracula, when he beat him, his body split up like the Dragon Balls and went all over the world, and he has to go and destroy the pieces of Dracula in different parts of the world. Castlevania 2 is also widely regarded as one of the worst ones in the series because it had a really weird time gimmick where while you're walking around the world, it will have a box of text that will come up and say, oh, this will be a terrible time to have a dark dream. And then it will change the world from what it is to a dark side of the world. And, you know, there'll be a whole bunch of enemies everywhere. Or if you were in an area, the enemies will come back and you have to fight your way and do whatever. But the problem with it is that it took a very long time for that scroll of text to come through. Like, it took like almost 2 minutes for it to finish. And then everyone would come back. And then if you end up like getting killed during that time period, or let's say you're attacking or jumping, you'll fall straight down. It just was not a good time. They ended up someone made it like redacted version of the game and they ended up making it a lot better. But then like with that game, it's kind of basic. Like, there's nothing that like really happened in that Castlevania game. Then you get to Castlevania 3. That one's Dracula's Curse. That's where Alucard's first introduced. So that's when you find out who Alucard is, which, you know, is literally Dracula backwards. He does not like his father. He doesn't like what his father's trying to do to the world. Dracula's back and booming. Never explain why Dracula ever comes back. He just appears sometimes.
They explain Alucard's mother at all?
No. He apparently just Godzilla'd out of him. Yeah. He's Godzilla's baby out of him.
Cloned him like Mini-Me.
And then you get introduced to another guy. His name is – I cannot remember his name. He's like got like weird frog-like powers. He doesn't get covered over in the series ever again. And then there's another person who happens to like kind of have the power of like Trevor, which this is the first game that Trevor gets introduced into while we were talking about the Netflix series. This is the first game he gets introduced to. And then the cool thing is that like each one of the characters can be swapped out. So you can play with the frog guy if you want to. You can play with Alucard if you want to. You can play with Trevor. So that was a big thing about that when you end up going up literally fighting Dracula once again, because that's the premise of every game. You fight Dracula. Why is he here? What is his purpose? But he never has a purpose besides, I want to blow up the world. Everyone should die. And I was like, okay, Dracula, that's helpful.
Typical antagonist, yeah, protagonist situation.
He's very much so that.
He's evil because he's evil.
Yeah, he's evil because he's evil. And then you end up getting to Super Castlevania 4, which is actually a remake of the first game.
So what console are we on by now?
We're still in the NES. This is all NES. Really? Yeah. Super Castlevania 4 is an SNES. Yeah,
it sounds like it with the name Super in it. That's why I asked.
Super Castlevania 4 is on SNES. It's literally a remake of the first game. People claim it's not, but it really is. The big thing about it is that like it added in new like textures and features to the game that you didn't have in the first game. Enemies worked a little bit differently because they could. They actually had the ability to do different things. The cool thing about it was is that they introduced the idea of being able to latch onto like weird magnets or circles all throughout the map, and you can either swing off of them with your whip or you can climb up and down them like ladders. That was like a big like pivotal point for the series. And then also, this is the first game where if you got hit on a ladder or stairs, you didn't get knocked down and possibly die. Because in the older games, like the issue was like you climb stairs, either you're stuck on them and you can't attack, or if you got hit on them, you could get knocked down.
It was a timing
concern,
yeah.
Yeah, so they introduced like a lot of like quality of life things for Castlevania, but like Super Castlevania 4 really didn't do too much for the series outside of just being a visual update. We didn't really start seeing a lot more updated games for the series until we got to Rondo of Blood. This introduces a newer character. His name's Richter.
Now, is that the sequel?
No, it's not a sequel. He's just a couple years later. It's like each one of these games is generally about 100 years later. Okay. Ending up like the newest they got to was like, I think, 2014 or something like that. Oh. But then you end up getting to Rondo of Blood, which was one on the Super Nintendo. It was one that actually never came to America didn't come for a very long period of time.
So it was on Famicom for a long time, mm-hmm, and it came
very
to
long
Super
time.
Nintendo.
Yeah, it actually never came to Super Nintendo. They only released it on the PSP back in 2006. So it came out in 93 or 2, and it didn't come here for almost 13 years.
There are a lot of games from Japan that ended up doing that same thing, where it came out in like the early 90s there, and then we didn't see it until 2000s, 2010s.
Yeah, like technically
that happened a lot with like Castlevania, Dragon Quest, Final Fantasy.
I bet they like, you know, publishers finally had a crew together to like redub everything into English.
The games didn't have any voice acting really.
No, so, but the textures and everything like that.
Literally all they did is that they just changed it from Japanese to English. They never really did anything outside of that.
I mean, as weird as it sounds, there's a little bit of overhead that goes along with that. So
There's things they have to do, like translation, or if there's cultural differences that they have to do. Yeah. But a lot of the Castlevania games, they were very lazy about it. It was literally just, all right, sweet, English, let's go.
Back then, Babel Bumblefish, copy paste. All right, let's go. All you race are belong to us.
Exactly. So then you get to the point where Richter is introduced. He has his qualms with Dracula, mainly because he has this girl named Maria that he meets. Maria is like this weird spellcaster that has like abilities to like summon like animals of sorts, right? So she's kind of like a shaman, I guess that would technically be the case, because she can summon like different animals and stuff like that. I don't know what.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like that was her big thing. But end up she got captured by Dracula. And he ended up having to go save her. So it kind of turned into a situation where it was like, no, you stole my girlfriend. How dare you? And, you know, he ends up going to fight Dracula and stuff like that. But you actually never kill Dracula in the game. But what ends up happening is it ties into Symphony of the Night. So Symphony of the Night is the PS1 game, which is regarded as one of the best games in the series.
I hear about.
By far things. One of the yep. greatest in the series.
It was one of the first games in the series that introduced the Metroidvania concept. So it had the storyboarding and map layout of like a Metroid game, but with the leveling system of a Castlevania or like, let's say, a normal RPG where you can level up your stats and collect different items to kind of upgrade your character. And this is also the first game that you played as Alucard as a main character. And this is a lot of people's first introduction to Alucard. And he's doing the same thing. He's like, I don't like my dad. What is my dad doing? I need to figure out what's going on.
And it's a new game on a new platform.
New platform, yeah. It's on the PS1. And then what ends up happening is in the beginning of the game, that's why I say like you don't end up really beating Dracula. In the beginning of the game, it's the end of Rondo of Blood. And it's Richter walking into the room with Dracula saying, hey, where's Maria? You took her from me. And then like Dracula goes on some weird like I hate humans kind of speech. And then they end up fighting one another. Richter beats him, and then that kind of dissipates. Richter just kind of gets lost. They don't know if he dies or not. He just kind of gets lost in this weird destruction of ash, and then you get Symphony of the Night. Symphony of the Night, it still had a very basic story where it's like Alucard literally is going through this castle, gaining all different abilities where he can actually shapeshift, so he can turn into like a dog if he wants to. He can turn into a bat. I believe there's another form that I can't remember right now. I think it was aquatic, so I think he can do like fish stuff and whatnot. But ends up getting like all these different powers, and he ends up fighting Dracula. But this is one of the first games that Death is introduced. So Death, Dracula apparently is best friends with Death. So he's like his right-hand man in a lot of situations. So like all the time you find out like you're going through the game and it's like, oh yeah, this is really cool. Oh, that's Death. Yep, he's going to be throwing sickles everywhere and it's going to be really difficult. Sweet. And then you end up like obviously beating him and going through that and all that niceness. But after that, there's a game that technically – this is the only Castlevania game that was not on a Nintendo console before Symphony of the Night. It's called Castlevania Bloodlines. This is the first game that was on the Sega Genesis and the only game on the Sega Genesis. And
I don't remember this one at all.
Yes.
There's a Castlevania game on the Genesis?
I remember Bloodlines.
Yep. It was on the Genesis. And it also was the first game that explained that the vampire killer could be used by someone else besides the Belmont clan. So – Belmont clan, technically speaking, the weapon is like blood bound to them. Like if you use it by anyone else, you technically won't be able to use it. You won't be able to pick it up. Think of it kind of like as a fingerprint gun, right? Like if you use your fingerprint on it and it's not yours, you
DNA
can't use it.
DNA gun. You have to be within the Belmont line to do it.
Yeah. Exactly. And what ends up happening is that the Belmonts are like – they kind of go into reclusion because Dracula's not doing dumb stuff for a good 400, 500 years. And they go into reclusion and they allow the Morrison family – to hold on to the vampire killer while they're gone. And what ends up happening, Jonathan Morrison, he ends up getting like the ability to use the vampire killer. And he ends up going through the game. I don't even think he fights Dracula in the game. He just teams up with his weird Native American friend that they don't really talk about too much after that. They go through and fight all these different like mythical beings. Like you have, you know, Frankenstein, you have, you know, the mummy
spirits.
Still. Yeah, spirits and stuff like that. And then they just had their weird like buddy cop movie and then that's the end of it. But then they never really talked about the Morrison clan or why they have the vampire killer ever again. It was like a shoddy game that they put on the Genesis for no reason. But then after that, story-wise, Symphony of the Night technically takes place in like the 1700s. So we're starting to get a little bit closer to a normal timeline. Then we end up getting into a game called I'm going to skip a couple just because they literally have no purpose anymore.
Which one are those?
So we're going to go with Circle of the Moon. That character is never mentioned again. He has no purpose. He does nothing. He technically dies in that game, so whatever.
That was their cash grab game.
Yeah.
And then, Game Boy Advance, wasn't it?
Yeah, Game Boy Advance. And then actually the thing too with Castlevania ended up living on with handheld games because people really liked the aesthetic of the 2D game and like the fact that you couldn't see your character's face except like the color of their skin kind of thing. So people really liked playing them on the handheld games because it kept the aesthetic. So they ended up living on that way. You didn't really see a Castlevania game on the consoles anymore. So then at that point, you skip Area of Sorrow. Oh, not sorry, Area of Sorrow. Circle of the Moon.
Character is not important. Whatever. He fights death, as always, because everyone fights death after he's introduced. Then Harmony of Dissonance, same deal. That game was just super flashy. It was the first game that introduced the idea of, like, when you're running around, there's, like, after images of you. I don't know why they did that, but whatever.
Wait, is that the one with the noodle whip?
Yes.
Yep.
That's the noodle. That's the good old-fashioned shoelace. Smack him up with the shoelace. But yeah, like that one was like, it didn't make too much sense either. I actually don't know that character's name, surprisingly enough, and I usually know quite a bit about Castlevania. But then when we get to Castlevania Aria of Sorrow, this is one that was game-changing. So it was a lot like Symphony of the Night, where it was a game that, you know, you could use whatever weapon you wanted. It had all these crazy things. You play as a guy named Soma. Yes.
What console?
Game Boy Advance still.
So, okay.
Yeah, still on the Game Boy Advance. The cool thing about him, we're in a time period where it's like 2010 or something like that, right? So super futuristic at the time. It came out in 2000, like four.
So it's a modern.
Modern, yes.
Take.
But here's the kicker. So Soma, he is the reincarnation of Dracula, but he doesn't know it. And he ends up going to see like some eclipse with his girlfriend in Tokyo. And then a couple other people are there with him. They end up they see the eclipse. When the eclipse happens, the castle. Eclipse happens, the castle for Dracula shows. They get slurped into the eclipse, and now they're in Dracula's castle, and now they have to figure out what's going on and try to get out of it. And then they end up finding out that they have to kill Dracula to get out of it. But he's Dracula. And it's like,
so I gotta kill myself?
I gotta kill myself? What's going on here? So you gotta go through this crazy storyline. But the cool thing about him is that he starts to realize his powers.
That's actually a pretty decent concept for a storyline.
It's pretty crazy. And then it gets to the point where he finds out that he has this latent ability where he can absorb the powers of others. So like example, like he can see a skeleton. Like skeletons usually when they run around, they throw a bone, right? Yeah. He can absorb that ability and now he can use a bone when he wants to. Or like let's say someone throws javelins and stuff like that. So he ends up finding out that he can like steal all these souls of these different enemies and use their abilities.
Kind of like Kirby,
except a lot darker. But yeah, then you end up going through the game
Vampire
of meeting all these.
Kirby.
Yeah, then you go through the game of meet all these different characters. So you meet like people who are like great for like helping you out with weapons. You find all these different weapons you can upgrade because he can use almost anything like guns, swords, lances, whatever. He ends up meeting this guy named Genya Arikado. Apparently, that's an anagram for Alucard because the guy is Alucard. He's just disguised as a normal human being.
Alucard.
Yeah. So like end up like he gets helped out by Alucard. He finds out that he is Dracula. Alucard is trying to kill him and he's trying to like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm a good guy and stuff like that. And you go through the game and all that niceness. But I could not do it in 10 minutes. I tried.
No, you could not.
It's like hard.
What else you got?
It's been like 15 minutes. It's a lot, dude.
He hasn't even got into like the DS games and then Kojima one. And
there's
then,
a lot more.
And then the ones that was like Kojima, like in between the Kojima games.
So much.
Oh, God.
I'm going to have to give up on it. We're going to have to dedicate this to something else. That's going to be like the weird Metal Gear Castlevania
episode.
We'll
have to make a podcast.
We're going
to
do.
That.
Yeah, I want to do it because like I love Castlevania and I want to go into it. But I just sucked up everyone's time. I'm sorry. But please, if you like Castlevania or looking for something that's a great side-scroller, please look into it. Because as you can see,
just pay Ferris to like do a video for like 10 hours.
Yeah, I'll do it. And then I'll just play through all the games.
We'll order pizza for him and just, you know, keep him
just for me.
For
sit in the room, finish it. Do it.
We'll do we were talking about LAN parties in a previous episode with the guy that was duct taped to the seat. We'll do that to you and just give you pizza and just okay, now on to the next Castlevania game.
I tried. The main premise is that there's a weapon called the Vampire Killer. It can only kill Dracula, and somehow it keeps getting into people's hands, and then they figure out ways to kill him without it. That's Castlevania, the series.
And it's a game series you love.
Very much. It's like Alex with Kingdom Hearts, so.
Yes.
And that was the whole point, is that we...
I didn't want to mention Kingdom Hearts because I knew he would do the same thing.
At least we took away enough time from the episode today for Alex to not gracefully mention
Kingdom Hearts. He was going to say Overwatch, and I was scared, dude.
Or Overwatch.
Okay, but with Overwatch, I can't talk that long about Overwatch.
You skirted, though. You said a lot of things that were very close to Overwatch, and I was afraid that we were going to talk about it.
There were a couple times that Ferris was holding his head going, oh, no, it's going to happen.
For
Kingdom Hearts.
Oh, yeah. But either way, I'm assuming that's all the time we have, isn't it, Brad?
That is all the time that we have.
I slipped it up.
When it comes to video game plots, there is a lot that goes into them, especially when you get into those multi-game kind of series. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we went into some of them, and we didn't even really touch on the surface of most of those that we mentioned. So
let alone most of the games.
This is definitely a topic we're going to have to revisit sometime in the future.
Yeah, maybe dedicate whole episodes to specific ones. Yeah,
right. So but until then, this has been The Breakfast Table, and you can remember to catch all our previous episodes on iTunes and Google Play, and catch us on social media like Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at 8BitWaffles. Until next time.